Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to today's Federalist Society virtual event. This afternoon, Friday, January 14th, we will be discussing vaccine mandates and policies. Who decides? I'm Alita Cass, Vice President for Strategic Initiatives at the Federalist Society and Director of the Freedom of Thought Project, an initiative addressing new challenges and questions involving freedoms of thought, conscience, and expression. The question of who should decide vaccine policy raises interesting questions of authority and freedom as a matter of law and also public policy. And we're looking forward to discussing these questions in light of the Supreme Court's decisions yesterday in two federal vaccine mandate cases. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion offered today are those of the experts on today's panel. We are fortunate to have with us Kate Todd to moderate today's panel discussion. Kate is the managing partner of Ellis George Cipollone's new Washington, D.C. office. She has a broad range of government, private sector, and nonprofit experience with particular expertise in administrative law and constitutional litigation. Kate is the former senior vice president and chief counsel for the U.S. Chamber Litigation Center, the litigation arm of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Kate served as a law clerk to Associate Justice Clarence Thomas of the U.S. Supreme Court and to Judge Michael Luttig of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. After our speakers have offered their opening remarks, our moderator will turn to submitted questions to direct the panel discussion. So please submit your questions through the Q&A feature at the bottom of our screen, of your screen. And with that, thank you for being with us today. Kate, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Thank you to the Federal Society for hosting today and to Alita, who is always at the forefront of thinking about freedom and our constitutional structure. Today's topic on vaccine mandates could not be more timely. And Justice Gorsuch's separate writing in one of the two decisions that came out from the Supreme Court yesterday said it very clearly. The central question we face today is who decides. That central question presents numerous axes of conflict, the individual versus everyone else, Congress or the executive branch or the administrators within the executive branch, federal or state or local government, private employers or private employees, school boards or teachers' unions or parents, and so on and so forth. Now, we can't possibly tackle all of those individual conflicts today, but I think we can tackle quite a few by looking through the federal mandates litigation and that the court decided. So we have a terrific lineup of experts with us. We have David Dewhurst, who is the Solicitor General of Montana. He has been in the driver's seat of the litigation that was before the court. As Montana, it was part of the coalition that brought challenges to both the healthcare workers vaccine mandate, that's the one through HHS, as well as the broader workforce vaccine mandate through OSHA. He's got tremendous experience building litigation against the government from his time at Freedom Foundation, served as a principal deputy general counsel at the Department of Commerce, and clerked for Judge Lawrence Van Dyke on the Ninth Circuit. We also have Professor Dorit Rubenstein Rice as the James Edgar Hervey Chair of Litigation at UC Hastings Law School. She earned her PhD from the Jurisprudence and Social Policy Program in UC Berkeley and has broad experience examining the accountability of government bodies. For today's purposes, she has also been focused extensively on legal and policy issues related to vaccines and has been very active in the public discourse about who decides. Professor Ilya Somin is professor of law at Antonin Scalia Law School. He's published and spoken extensively on liberty and the proper role of government. and has also been very active in the public discourse on vaccine mandates generally and on the Supreme Court cases specifically. He served as a visiting scholar or visiting professor at law schools throughout the world, was an Olin Fellow at Northwestern and clerk for Judge Jerry Smith of the Fifth Circuit. Finally, we have Ryan Newman, who is general counsel to Governor Ron DeSantis, which has a booming tourist trade for those of us from DC, but I'm not going to speak too much about that today. He has previously served as counselor to the Attorney General for National Security and International Affairs and in various other high-ranking positions throughout the Trump administration. He had a view from the legislative branch as chief counsel to Senator Ted Cruz, clerk for Justice Alito, and Judges Dick Leon of the DDC, Judge Edmondson of the 11th Circuit, and was an officer in the United States Army who deployed to Iraq for Operation Iraqi Freedom. So we're going to turn to David. So our order today is going to turn to David first to set the stage on the federal mandate litigation and the decisions that came out. And then we'll go to Dorit, to Ilya, to Ryan for opening remarks. I will do my best to stay out of the way and let these experts discuss this topic with each other. And then time permitting, we'll also bring in questions from the audience. So with that, David, can you please kick us off?
Definitely. Thank you, Kate. And thank you to the Federal Society for the opportunity to talk about this very timely issue. As you all know, we got decisions yesterday, and it's sort of fallen to me to do a quick overview of what we learned yesterday and to just provide a recap of the litigation that's been going on for the last several weeks on these various issues. Very, very happy to be appearing on this panel with distinguished co-panelists and excited for the discussion ahead, especially my friend down in Florida. Ryan is the general counsel for Governor DeSantis in Florida, which we in Montana refer to as Southern Montana. And so we're very excited to be able to discuss these things with everyone today. So the story really begins on this about September 9th, when President Biden held a press conference in the midst of what was a very unfortunate misadventure in withdrawing from Afghanistan, and announced that we were going to be pivoting on the issue of vaccines and responding to the COVID-19 pandemic. And what we learned is that he had several broad plans to increase vaccination among Americans. And he very explicitly expressed his displeasure and that his patience was wearing thin with those who refused to obtain the COVID-19 vaccine. And so we learned then what was coming down the pike. OSHA was going to be issuing an emergency temporary standard for a huge number of American workers at larger companies. We learned that CMS at Health and Human Services was going to be issuing a rule for healthcare workers, and that the president was going to take action with respect to federal contractors and public employees in the federal space. Several weeks later, on November 5th, we got both the OSHA and the CMS rules. OSHA came in the form of an ETS. It applied, as you all know, to employers with 100 or more employees. The vaccines were mandatory. Employers had the option of alternatively requiring weekly testing and masking for those employees who didn't want to get vaccinated, although they didn't have to offer that exception. And there were very steep fines put in place for each infraction and for willful violations of that emergency temporary standard. As we all know, everyone in America basically challenged the OSHA rule in every circuit court using the petition for review process that's provided for in the OSHA statute when it comes to emergency temporary standards. The Fifth Circuit quickly stated that the ETS stayed the ETS, finding that the petitioners were likely to succeed in showing that the OSHA mandate grossly exceeded OSHA's statutory authority. And by rule, then all of the different circuit petitions were consolidated in the Sixth Circuit. Then there was a flurry of activity where many of the petitioners, including the states in which Montana was a part, and Ohio at this point sort of took the leading role as sort of a home state within the Sixth Circuit. We all moved for initial en banc consideration. The court denied that because of an 8-8 vote. And in that denial, Chief Judge Sutton and Judge Bush both dissented, and they echoed and expanded upon the Fifth Circuit stay, reasoning that the mandate was obviously in excess of OSHA's statutory authority. Shortly thereafter, a three-judge panel in the Sixth Circuit dissolved the Fifth Circuit stay and concluded that the mandate was in fact consistent with OSHA's statutory and constitutional authority, and Judge Larson dissented from that decision. After that, many parties filed applications for a stay with the Supreme Court, and two of those cases were consolidated. In fact, the two in which the court called oral argument on January 7th and yesterday issued decisions, the NFIB case and the Coalition of States. The CMS interim final rule was also published on November 5th. And this one is a simpler rule with very few exceptions. It requires covered staff, which is most everyone at Medicare and Medicaid covered facilities, to obtain a COVID-19 vaccination. Non-compliance can result in monetary penalties, the denial of funding for new admissions at those facilities, or complete termination from the Medicaid and Medicare programs. And so it was high stakes, both for the states and for these facilities, as well as patients who rely on this funding in order to get the healthcare that they need. Two coalitions of states raised challenges. There were more coalitions, but we'll talk about the two that actually made it up to the Supreme Court. One led by Missouri and Nebraska, the other led by Louisiana, Montana, and Arizona. Those were filed in the Western District of Louisiana and the Eastern District of Missouri. And the states attacked the CMS rule on various grounds. They argued there is no good cause for dispensing with the notice and comment requirement that generally applies to rules that the agency has to issue. The big million-dollar question that we argued that the CMS lacked the statutory authority to enact the mandate. And that even if some authority could be scratched out of the statute that would authorize something like this, this was a major question that would require a clear congressional statement authorizing this sort of mandate, and we argued that that didn't exist. And then we made a litany of other challenges to the rule, arbitrary and capricious challenges, as well as some other statutory violation arguments. The district courts in both locations enjoined the rule. In the Western District of Louisiana, there was a nationwide injunction that the Fifth Circuit later limited. The federal government sought stays from both the Fifth and Eighth Circuits, and those were denied. They sought relief in the Supreme Court. And so, as you all know, the court heard oral argument on those arguments on January 7th as well. And we got decisions in those cases yesterday. So first, quickly, I'll talk about the OSHA decision. You know, it's a short, straightforward decision, and it came out as many predicted. The court leaned into the clear statement, major questions doctrine. First, it determined that the ETS mandate was obviously a question of vast economic and political significance, a measure meant to ensure the vaccination of 84 million Americans, and one that has never been undertaken by OSHA before. OSHA, the court explained, may regulate to mitigate occupational risks, but the mandate confuses the important difference between occupational risks and risks that exist in general, to the general public, which means that the OSHA mandate is in fact not an occupational regulation. It is a public health regulation. And there's not clear congressional authorization for OSHA to regulate in this way. Plus, there's no other evidence out there that Congress authorized OSHA to take this sort of action. In fact, there's contrary evidence in the Senate's December 8th denunciation of the ETS. Finally, and importantly for the CMS discussion, which we'll get into in just a second, the court observed that OSHA had never exerted this type of regulatory control before. And that was telling, the court thought. They quoted from the Free Enterprise Fund case, "The lack of historical precedent coupled with the breadth of authority that the secretary now claims is a telling indication that the mandate extends beyond the agency's legitimate reach." So an important part of the analysis in OSHA, in addition to the fact that the statutory citations that the government was citing just simply couldn't carry the freight of this mandate, but the fact that this was an unprecedented action. OSHA had never done anything like this before. So that's the OSHA decision. There's a lengthy dissent by comparison, I suppose, from Justices Breyer, Sotomayor and Kagan, and it's worth a read. And an interesting concurrence from Justice Gorsuch, where he leans in a little bit harder to the major questions doctrine. Going over to the CMS decision, and maybe provide a little bit more detail on this one, since I was more intimately involved in this case, and I'm in the Federalist Society presentation stage of grief, which is somewhere in between denial and rage. But the CMS, the court concluded that the CMS mandate falls within the authorities that Congress has conferred upon the secretary. So the principal question at issue, the court concluded without much analysis, that this type of mandate is well within the statutory authority that Congress has granted to the secretary in order to regulate the Medicare and Medicaid programs. Interestingly, the decision relied upon Section 1395, 42 U.S.C. 1395, which was the statutory section that the Solicitor General relied on principally in briefing, but was not what CMS actually relied on principally when they published the IFR. They relied on different statutes that had to do with the administrative, the efficient administration of the programs. But we saw a shift in briefing to Section 1395, which has to do with the secretary's ability to regulate for health and safety of patients who are in covered facilities. And that's what the court grappled onto, and that's really what the basis of the decision is. In fact, the court held that this fits neatly, the mandate fits neatly within the language of the statutes. Now, if you have just read the OSHA mandate case, that decision, and you come to this paragraph, it will, as it did for me, present quite a surprise, because in fact, I think the situation in both cases was pretty similar, and we're dealing with similar sort of attenuated statutes, which I'll talk a little bit more about here in just a second. But nonetheless, the court concluded that this was the type of statute that contemplated a vaccine mandate. Now, in order to reach this conclusion, it sort of ignored the fact that the arguments about these authorities in Section 1395 appear in these residual catch-all provisions of definitional statutes. 1395, for instance, XE9 has to do with hospitals, and there are a slew of other statutes that have to do with defining other covered facilities. And many of those, not all of them, but many of them have these health and safety residual provisions. As Justice Thomas points out in his dissent, that's not the type of provision which can justify such a profound departure from previous practice. And as a matter of statutory construction, that's a little bit of a dubious conclusion. So the court found that this smattering of residual authority statutes found in the Social Security Act was sufficient for the omnibus vaccine mandate that applies to all covered facilities. And there wasn't a whole lot more discussion about the statutory analysis that the court undertook. But that's sort of what we have. Interestingly, I pointed out in the brief discussion about the OSHA decision that the court talked about the history of regulations that OSHA has enacted under their statutory provisions. The court did the same here, but it seemed to sort of reverse polarities. And it basically said that the vaccine mandate is similar in kind to the host of conditions that the secretary already imposes on covered facilities. Things like training, things like credentialing, hand washing, and infection control sterilizing procedures, things like that. The court basically concluded this is one and the same. This is not a profound departure from those previous types of regulations. And so this is also something that can be neatly captured within the statutory grants of authority. In my opinion, I think the court read sort of a pixelated broadness into the statutory language, so broad that the obvious differences between a vaccine mandate and the various training, credentialing, hand washing, sterilizing procedures that the secretary has long imposed sort of gets washed out. I think Justice Thomas points this out, and so does Justice Alito in their two dissents, that obviously this is different in kind. This is something new, as CMS recognized when they published the IFR. They've never done something like this. And there is a difference between each of those types of procedures and, of course, the sort of the irreversible nature, as Justice Alito put it, of a vaccine. The court then pretty summarily dismissed the APA arguments, the arbitrary and capricious arguments, and opined, albeit briefly, on issues that the Solicitor General had failed to raise in her application. In short, they concluded the record supported the Secretary's various findings, concluded that the Secretary apparently didn't ignore the effects that this would have on rural hospitals and clinics, and the district court's other critiques of the interim final rule were apparently not deferential enough. They were too searching, and apparently the district court owed a little bit more deference to the Secretary's findings. The court also concluded that the good cause exemption was satisfied, and so the interim final rule was appropriate. The need to seek notice and comment before they published, and the reasoning was that the Secretary wanted to get this out in front of the winter flu season. There's apparently no requirements that the Secretary consult with states before they publish an IFR, which strikes our coalition at least as a significant workaround from the way that the Social Security Act is designed as a quintessential act of cooperative federalism. And then lastly, the court concluded that there's no violation of the statutory prohibition on federal supervision and control over the tenure and selection of healthcare employees. Now, this was a pretty clear argument that we made, and I thought a pretty strong one. And the reasoning that the court provided, I think in one sentence, was that if we took that point sort of as it's presented in the statute, if we took it plainly, then that would call into question the host of other regulations that the Secretary has long imposed on employees and facilities under the program. Now, whether or not that's actually statutory construction or not, I guess can be left to the reader. But obviously, we think that was a serious problem because this, in a new and unprecedented way, does interfere with the selection and tenure of employees at healthcare facilities. As I mentioned a couple times, Justice Thomas penned a very strong dissent where he talks about the lack of statutory authority for this vaccine mandate. And Justice Alito wrote a dissent where he talks about the good cause exemption and why the government did not demonstrate that was actually satisfied. So very quickly, I'll just make a few observations and then I'll pass this along. On the OSHA mandate decision, I think this does what a lot of us expected. And I think we're going to see a continuing development of the clear statement doctrine, the major questions doctrine. And I think this potentially will have serious implications for later cases this term. Cases like the Clean Air Act case brought by West Virginia. I think that's going to be a serious consideration for the court. If the OSHA mandate did not pass muster, then I think the EPA's maybe in for some trouble on their Clean Air Act regulations. On the CMS case, I think there are some real questions that we have going forward, just from a litigation perspective, about what the standards of review are and what the burdens are that parties have to meet when they actually approach the court with a stay application. You know, in the CMS case, only Justice Thomas discussed the standard, and he seemed to apply it throughout. But that's interesting and a problem, I think, in a case like CMS, because unlike the OSHA case, this was this when you stack the stay standard on top of the fact that we have a lower court preliminary injunction, the likelihood that the Supreme Court will reverse is you have to look at that through the lens of abuse of discretion. And I don't think the majority opinion, the per curiam opinion, actually does that. They seem to approach this purely in a de novo posture. And that's a real problem, because allowing this rule to go into effect essentially gives the federal government full relief that it seeks. By the time this is further litigated below, healthcare workers are going to have to make hard decisions about whether or not they want to submit to the vaccine or whether they're going to leave their jobs. This is it's when the standards are not really clearly articulated or clearly applied in the state posture, I think this leads to some questions about, you know, what exactly we're doing in a state posture, or whether in fact this is the Supreme Court issuing some sort of final decree on this very important legal question. And if that's the case, I'm not sure that we really presented enough briefing, and there's been enough lower court development of the law and the facts on these issues to justify that. Next, you know, what about forfeiture and waiver? The Solicitor General in this stay application left three bases upon which the district court granted the injunction below, left those completely out of the brief. And that alone would seem to show that the government can't meet its burden. And so, you know, the court went out and reached these arguments, but it didn't address the problem of waiver at all. And so I think, you know, that's an open question moving forward about, you know, when the rules of waiver and forfeiture actually apply. And what about other arguments? I mean, the court in the CMS decision, for instance, addressed the statutory question and the arbitrary and capricious questions. It didn't address other bases that the district court ruled on, such as the 10th Amendment argument brought by the states or the non-delegation challenge. And it didn't specifically discuss pretext either, which is an interesting new doctrine in the last few years, as we all know. And so maybe it was couched in some of the summary language in the court's per curiam opinion, but it wasn't specifically addressed. So we're not really sure what to do with those types of arguments that the court just didn't reach. And finally, and I think most importantly from a public policy perspective, this decision takes the Solicitor General up on her invitation in their reply brief to basically transform HHS from a sort of check writing and fiduciary agency that administers these insurance programs into a federal public health agency. And that should be concerning, because there's no real limiting principle on what the secretary could do as it relates to health and safety. If the statutes the court cited are broad enough to allow this type of regulation, it's hard to see what other types of decisions couldn't be made under that same heading. So those are some of my observations. I'm happy to turn this over, but that's a quick summary of the decisions. Obviously colored a little bit by my experience, but anyway, happy to turn it over now.
Thank you, David. Doree?
So first of all, thank you, David, for setting this so thoroughly and so well. My feelings are probably kind of the opposite of yours, which is less happiness about the OSHA decision, although my feelings on that are very mixed, because I keep going back and forth on whether the OSHA rule was a good idea on policy grounds, and somewhat relief on the CMS. But that's not what I want to focus on. We have limited time and you can talk for a day on each of these topics. So I'll try to stick to my notes, and I have 6 points to make, but I want to start with something that David said towards the end, and on which I'd like to hear the views of my co-panelists, which is, I think David is completely right that for both these cases, the Supreme Court kind of finished the case, even though this was only a question of emergency procedure. And I think David points that if this was dispositive, maybe there wasn't enough briefing is something we need to keep in mind. I do think these were dispositive, and I'd like to hear whether my co-panelists agree. I want to make one general statement about public health policy, and then 4 observations about OSHA and 2 about CMS. And I hope I can do that in 5 minutes. So, generally speaking, when it comes to public health policies, a traditional view is public health response should start low and go up. So the first point of response should be on the local level, with states next and the federal government coming in. Though in practice, for big public health issues, we always have a multi-level response. Think from the Flint contamination, the Flint crisis, the horrible event that happened there, to hurricanes. We usually do have a multi-level response. The question is, what sphere should each of the levels take, rather than who should act? That doesn't answer the question for these specific measures, but I want to remind you that we do usually see a multi-level response for every public health crisis. At the very least, the federal government has a bigger purse than individual states and can offer support. talking more specifically about these measures, let me start with the OSHA decision. In terms of the statutory interpretation, I think the dissent had the better argument here. And the reasoning is that I think the dissent was right, that there's nothing in the statutes that draws the line that the court drew of particular of hazards particular to the workplace versus general hazards. And we have historically seen OSHA measures that address things that come up in other contexts, such as sanitation and electricity. That doesn't mean there wasn't a very good argument for the Supreme Court to strike down the ETS on, but I would expect it to see to focus more on the criteria for granting an ETS. We know that ETS have been rarely used. We know that they have been struck down before and the courts narrow the requirements. I was a little surprised that more of the debate and more of the decision wasn't focused on whether this is a grave danger across all workplace and whether this was necessary across workplace. As it was, I think the statutory interpretation here was unconvincing. And that's independent of the major question doctrine. The second thing I want to address directly is the major question doctrine. I have three issues with it, two general and one is applied here. The first thing is the major question doctrine as we currently use it is undefined. It's basically, I know it when I see it, and that's the way it was applied in the OSHA case. We have had such standards before. It's not unheard of in our legal system, but it's a tricky way to do law because it gives little guidance to parties across the board. If the goal of the major question decision, as I understand it, is to curb an administrative discretion and make sure that an administrative agency doesn't step into the area of litigating from its executive bench, there are other more principled ways to do that than a doctrine that's so well defined. For example, New York City uses a non-delegation doctrine called Borelli, in which they really try to parse out, is the administrative agency litigating or acting as administrator with a multi-criteria test. That's one way. In general, we will strike down your actions retroactively because Congress did not authorize them and we think it's going too far without giving guidance on what this means, seems to me a less principled way to do this. And I also see the doctrine to some degree as an escape route from overturning or narrowing the current non-delegation doctrine, which is a very weak non-delegation doctrine. I think if you want to say we need to have a stronger non-delegation doctrine, you should say that openly rather than use major questions as a way to not confront the current non-delegation doctrine. In this case in particular, I think applying major questions is tricky. And here's why. An ETS is an emergency power. And the weight in the OSHA Act is not uncabined. In fact, the OSHA Act carefully circumscribes when you can use an ETS, and the lower courts did address those factors in their in issuing the stay, whether this is a grave danger and whether this is necessary. The core of an emergency power is you don't know how it's going to be used. Congress can't be more specific about an emergency power simply because you don't know what the emergency is and you don't know what will be needed. The vaccine mandate is certainly much broader than much else, but COVID-19 is a much bigger crisis than we've faced in the workplace before. I think saying that the ETS power is a situation where Congress did not give specific enough delegation is problematic because for an emergency power, it's really hard to do otherwise. So it's a bit of a strange application of the major question doctrine, which I think follows from the fact that the doctrine is so well defined. Two other points. One, a litigation point. The court, in the majority of the court here, in addressing the balance of equity, basically said, on one hand, we have claims of economic damage, and on the other hand, we have death. We can't decide between that. But when it comes to a stay, the court has to decide this question. One of the criteria for issuing a stay is what's the balance of equities. And I think the court has decided it. And it would have been appropriate for the court, if it thinks the balance of equity is in favor of the economic harm rather than the COVID harm, to be open about that again. This is not a case we're saying we would rather not decide works because the court is deciding, the court is issuing a stay. And finally, as it is, I think the effect of the major question doctrine is to remove areas in which Congress delegated power to an agency to the courts. In, I think the dissent here was right that on the who decides question, the way major question operate now is giving the power to the courts. And as problematic as certainly Congress isn't perfect and agencies aren't perfect, there's a lot to fix on both, but I don't think the courts are a better place to make policy for a lot of reasons. On the CMS question, I actually have 3 points. One is, in the discussion, the fact that this that CMS is basically a funding power issue came up. There wasn't a lot of that in the decision, and I was a little surprised by that. Second, in terms of the statutory interpretation, I hear David that there really is, I think David is completely right that the statutory interpretation here is in tension with OSHA, with the statutory interpretation in the OSHA case. I think it's the OSHA case that was wrong, but I think he's right that the court acted one way in the first case and another way here. And I think because I think the OSHA case was wrong, I think the court was right here in saying this is a broad delegation. It's backed up by specific delegations, not across the board, but for several of these institutions that give the power to regulate health and safety. And it's backed up by a past practice. I think that's right. Where I think the CMS rule was most vulnerable is on the procedural question. And I think Justice Alito was completely right that we only rarely countenance exceptions to the notice and comments requirements. On the other hand, the secretary did give an argument, and I think the majority was right that 2 months time to create a 73-page document, given the way our administrative agency moves, is within the rights. But I think the procedural issue is a very real one and deserved calling out and pushing on.
Thank you, Dori. And I want to insert a housekeeping matter before we switch over to Ilya. And that's just if you do have questions for the panelists, please use the question and answer function. I think we have them potentially coming in from a, multiple directions. But if you can submit them through question and answer, that would be great. And let's turn now to Ilya.
I'd like to thank the Federalist Society for organizing this in a very timely way, and for my two previous co-panelists for their very thoughtful discussions. I'm going to start off by talking a little bit about the two Supreme Court decisions that were issued yesterday. I've also been asked to talk about the broader issue of state governments and the private sector and their authority or lack thereof to impose vaccination mandates. So with respect to yesterday's decisions, I'm in an unaccustomed position of moderation. That is that I'm sort of in between my two co-panelists, and that one of them thinks that both vaccine mandates were illegal. The other one, I think, Dori, you can correct me if I have this wrong, but I think you believe that both are legal. I actually agree with the court in both decisions. So I'm sort of the moderate here. The New York Times once said that I'm a centrist, which I think is not actually accurate for most issues, but it may be accurate for this set of decisions. And I'll very briefly try to describe why I think that both decisions are right and not in any significant conflict with each other. The big difference is that the ETS OSHA mandate is much broader than the other one, and it stretches the statute much more. Here, I agree with the court in focusing on the major questions doctrine. If they're saying it's a major question, it's imposing vaccination on 84 million people, large part of the workforce, and so forth. That seems like a very big policy decision. But I do also agree with Dori and all the dissenting justices when they say that the attempt to distinguish between dangers that are unique or primarily in the workplace and dangers that also exist else, right? I think that's unconvincing. I think if the statute, the way it's written, I think it permits regulation of a danger that exists in the workplace, if it's a grave danger, regardless of whether that same danger also exists somewhere else. However, the words grave danger are the ones that I think are crucial here, in that the ETS authority is limited. It's a special circumvention of normal procedures. So it can't be imposed for just any danger. It has to be a grave danger. And here is where I think the indiscriminate nature of the ETS rule dooms it, in that it imposes it on almost all employees of employers with over 100 workers, regardless in most cases of the actual degree of risk that they face. And importantly, the agency only found a grave danger to exist for unvaccinated workers. And this means that the grave danger, if it exists at all, only exists for a group of employees who could very easily mitigate it themselves simply by getting vaccinated. And if OSHA under ETS has the authority to regulate or impose constraints on anything, even if it's a danger that can very easily be mitigated by the employees themselves, then almost all activities that we engage in ordinary life and in the workplace can potentially be considered grave dangers and restricted. Even walking down the stairs is a grave danger. If you don't look where you're going, you can fall and seriously injure yourself. There are many other examples like this in almost every workplace. So I think there's an important difference between a danger like this, which is very easily mitigated, and one which is the kind of thing is more typically regulated by OSHA, where its mitigation is harder, it might be more costly, it might be something employers prefer to avoid and so forth, or incentivize the employees to avoid. Here, that's simply not the case. And this, to my mind, is the real problem with the scope of the ETS rule. ETS could perhaps be used to require vaccination in some narrower circumstances where, for whatever reason, there are employees who cannot mitigate, perhaps immunodeficient employees and so forth. I think if the court had gone the other way on this, it would have given OSHA almost a blank check to use ETS to regulate virtually every aspect of the workplace. And I think that would have been very problematic. Those who might trust the Biden administration with this power, think about what if Donald Trump becomes president in the future, or some other Republican, do you trust that person? And I think, it's important, therefore, to have at least some major questions constraints, even though I readily grant that, as Dorit says, it's a vague doctrine, its precise boundaries are fuzzy. But this is not a close borderline case for that doctrine. This is one where if the doctrine is going to be imposed at all, this falls within it. I also agree with much of what Justice Gorsuch said in his concurring opinion about non-delegation, but non-delegation, while I favor enforcing it more rigorously, it's not a doctrine that's as well developed by any means as the major questions doctrine. So I can readily understand the court in a decision that they had to write within just a few days. I totally understand their reluctance to go deeply into non-delegation and how it works and to really break new ground there, whereas I don't think much new ground had to be broken to deal with this through major questions. Briefly on the CMS case, I think here you just have a differently worded statute. You have various provisions which say that CMS can regulate to protect, quote, the health and safety of patients and service recipients in facilities that receive Medicare and Medicaid funds. And I think, the exact boundaries of what counts as health and safety can be fuzzy. And in borderline cases, there might be challenges based on the spending clause, which might work, or based on other statutory interpretation principles. But I just don't think this particular case is close. If there's anything that relates to health and safety of patients and service recipients, it's preventing or at least limiting the spread of a deadly disease that might kill them. And here it's worth noting that the population we are dealing with, hospital patients, nursing home patients, and so forth, particularly in the Medicare case where they are elderly, they are people who are especially vulnerable to COVID-19. The REIT probably has the exact data on this, but as I understand it, something like 30 or 40% of all American deaths from COVID-19 were in nursing home and long-term care facilities. And this is a group that includes many people who are immunodeficient and can't easily avoid the problem through simply by getting vaccination themselves. But in any event, the wording about grave danger actually is not in this statute. So a health and safety risk, which is significant, but not quite a grave danger, that's something that CMS can still use to protect against. And again, this does not threaten to give the Secretary of Health and Human Services authority over all of society or even all of public health. It's limited to people who work in these facilities, though I know there can be some borderline questions about independent contractors and the like. I do recognize there's this provision about the selection of employees and the like, but I think the court's response was correct. This is not directly saying you must hire X person or you can't hire Y. This is simply saying whoever you do hire has to obey certain rules. And with any kind of regulation of any sort, even a purely administrative one, if you have employees who just refuse to obey the regulation or whatnot, then the employer might have to discipline them or in the extreme case, even fire them. So I think this particular provision should be read in the context of the statute as a whole. And therefore, what it does is it should forbid direct federal control of hiring criteria, but not some indirect impact that comes from the fact that whenever there's a regulation of any kind, employers will often have to enforce it by saying employees who don't obey the regulation may get fired or penalized or what have you. Much more could be said about both cases, but that's at least my general perspective on the two and why the two are different and why I think the court got both cases right, though there certainly were some lacuna in their reasoning in both cases. And, you know, I think the product that we saw reflects the fact that this was put together very quickly and therefore maybe an example of the concerns that some people on both right and left have raised about sort of the court deciding cases on the emergency shadow docket, as it's called, and in some cases, very important cases. This is not the first. We've also had the eviction moratorium and some others. Briefly on the estates and the private sector, I think by contrast with the federal government, which has only in some ways quite limited authority to impose vaccination mandates, state and local governments, at least as far as the federal constitution is concerned, have pretty broad authority to do so under their police and public health powers. The Supreme Court said as much in Jacobson versus Massachusetts in 1905. Some people interpret Jacobson as a complete blank check for all vaccination mandates at the state level, or even as a blank check for almost any public health measures. I don't read it quite that expansively. The court specifically said that maybe constitutionally exemptions would be required for people who face grave health risks from a vaccine. And there, I think it's also fair to say that if the evidence just shows that, you know, a vaccine just doesn't work or the like, then that might also be unconstitutional. But in general, this authority is pretty broad. To my mind, it would be useful to draw a distinction between a paternalistic vaccine mandate, which protects solely or almost solely the person who gets the vaccine, versus one that's intended to limit the spread of disease to other people. That distinction is not in current Supreme Court precedent. I think perhaps it should be. Even if it's not going to be in the precedent, it's at least a relevant moral consideration for anyone who values liberty. But I should add that at least even currently, the COVID vaccines do in fact significantly constrain the spread, albeit less so with the Omicron variable than previous ones. And I think that's so I do not think COVID vaccine mandates are in fact the purely paternalistic kind. Finally, with respect to the private sector, a number of states, and I'm sorry to say mostly conservative Republican states, have enacted laws preventing even private sector employers or businesses from requiring vaccination vaccination of their employees or of customers. I think this is wrong from a health point of view. It's also wrong from the standpoint of liberty and freedom of association, that even if you don't think the government should impose certain vaccine mandates, it makes perfect sense to allow private firms to do so. Among other things, this respects a diversity of preferences that people have. Some people are more risk averse than others. It should be perfectly acceptable to businesses to cater to the more risk averse by having vaccination requirements, and also employees who are less likely to get severely ill. They might be better employees for obvious reasons. And that's also a decision that a private business should be allowed to take. There's some irony. There's been a lot of scrambling of traditional ideological alignments under COVID. One is on the left suddenly taking a very permissive attitude towards emergency measures that severely restrict civil liberties and the like, which they would not do in other contexts. On the right, they have forgotten much of their devotion to private property rights and freedom of contract and the like. And in few places is that more evident than in a debate over private vaccine requirements. So I'll stop there. I apologize if I've overrun my time a little bit. And I very much look forward to the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Ilya. I have one suggestion for PR. Instead of moderation, you might use the word nuanced for your approach.
Well, just as I'm both nuanced.
Moderate, so I'm just telling you.
Yeah, I'm both nuanced and moderate, except when the moderation would not be nuanced, perhaps.
Okay, got it. Got it. Ryan.
I just took a note. Ilya, moderate, check. I got you on the list now. Well, hey, it's a real privilege to be on the panel. Thanks a lot for having me. It's great to be appearing from the Sunshine State, or as Governor DeSantis would say, the free state of Florida. So thanks for having me. I'm going to take a little different spin on this. I don't really want to get into. I mean, you all have gone over the cases in great detail. I'm not really going to dwell on that. I want to look at this question of who decides from a more sort of philosophical perspective. I actually think this is a incredibly important question, this question of who decides, because it reveals so much about what kind of regime we live under. I mean, is this a centralized regime, a decentralized regime? Are we a republic anymore? Or are we a bureaucratic state or some sort of aristocracy where the aristocrats are experts? Is the true locus of power in our society the individual anymore, or is it the government? Is it corporations? And so the way I look at this who decides question is it operates on essentially three dimensions. The first is, you know, should the federal government decide or the states? The second, should the people's representatives in the state legislatures or in the Congress decide, or should experts in the bureaucracy decide? And the third is, you know, should the government decide, or should the government leave it up to the marketplace? I intend to address each of these as briefly as I can, and I will apologize in advance because I didn't time any of this, so I have no idea how long I will drone on, but I will try not to drone on for too long. And then discuss a little bit, you know, what we're doing down here in Florida. So with respect to the first dimension, this issue of the federal government versus the states, well, nobody really disputes that public health and the control of infectious diseases fall squarely within the state's police power. You know, absent some infringement of a constitutional right, states have maximum latitude to pursue whatever vaccine policies they choose. But that's not the case for the federal government. Unlike the states, the federal government does not have plenary public health authority. But that hasn't stopped or prevented the Biden administration from attempting to impose nationwide vaccine mandates as if it had such authority. And the sweep of these mandates is really, truly extraordinary and unprecedented when you're talking about the many millions of Americans, almost as many as 100 million, maybe even more, who are subject to these mandates. And we've talked about the CMS vaccine mandates. We've talked about the OSHA mandates, but these aren't the only ones. I mean, the federal government is exercising its federal contractor authority to require all of its contractors to impose mandates on their employees, too. And that's not a small thing, considering how much money the federal government slings around these days. But I mean, they've even gone so far as imposing a vaccine mandate in the Head Start program, for goodness sakes. I mean, they're telling two-year-olds that they've got to mask up in the Head Start program. So, you know, the federal government is exercising extraordinary authority here. Now, none of these delegations, I think, were ever intended to confer general public health authority on the federal government. So I think, obviously, that the Supreme Court got it right in the OSHA case, and I think it was miserably wrong in the CMS case. So the question then is, well, what does this mean for the states? And certainly, what does it mean for Florida? And I think things could get, you know, a little interesting down here. And that's because Florida has, you know, embraced its own policy, its own approach to dealing with the pandemic. You know, in Florida, the legislature decided to prohibit employers, including healthcare providers, from requiring their workers to be vaccinated, you know, unless the employer offered broad exemptions for medical or religious reasons, past infection, or regular COVID testing. Florida just made the judgment that, you know, educating the public, voluntary vaccination, and other precautions struck a better balance than heavy-handed blanket vaccine mandates. So the question is, now that the CMS rule has been, you know, kept in place by the Supreme Court, well, what does this mean for Florida's law? Well, I think there'll be some interesting questions here. But for now, Florida intends to enforce its laws. And what that will mean for, you know, a lot of healthcare providers remains to be seen. I guess one could make the argument that this is not even a conflict, really, because, as you know, as the liberal justices reminded us, you know, these requirements that attach to Medicare and Medicaid, this is just a spending program. Those are just conditions for a spending program, and nobody apparently, you know, has to accept those dollars. But the bottom line here is the federal government's trying to impose, you know, on the country, a uniform nationwide public health policy. But we think that that's dangerous because it puts the entire country at the mercy of the federal bureaucracy and its policy judgments. But what if the federal government's judgment is wrong? Well, we all suffer then as a result. We think it's much better to let the states experiment with their own policies. We can learn from each other to find a way out of the pandemic. And this leads me to the second dimension of the who decides question. This is the issue of is it the people's representatives who decide, or is it the experts who decide? And I think this was at the center of the dispute in the OSHA case. So you have Justice Gorsuch, he says, the question before us is not how to respond to the pandemic, but who holds the power to do so. The answer is clear. Under the laws that stands today, that power rests with the states and Congress, not OSHA. It's interesting to read the dissent. They pose almost the exact same question. They say, who decides how much protection and of what kind American workers need from COVID-19? They say, an agency with expertise in workplace health and safety, acting as Congress and the president authorized. So clearly they have two very different perspectives here. Well, there's no question that public health policy should be grounded in sound data and studies. Nobody really disputes that. And there's no question as well that experts in public health should certainly be consulted. But the views of these experts should not generally supersede or displace the judgment of legislators and elected leaders. And our legal frameworks should be constructed in some way as to maximize or to prevent that from happening. By the very nature of their role, elected leaders must take account of and mediate between all the competing interests that are implicated by a particular problem. An expert, on the other hand, has a narrow focus and is oftentimes incapable of or poorly suited to the task of balancing or even recognizing interests that are outside of the expert's field. It takes elected leaders, legislators, governors to see the big picture and respond accordingly. Late 19th century and early 20th century progressives like Woodrow Wilson, for instance, believe that the American government, with its bicameral legislature, separation of powers and checks and balances, was incapable of addressing complex challenges of modern industrial society. This belief gave rise to the administrative state we have today. They believed that experts rather than legislators could better steer the ship of state. But this reminds me actually of a quote that I just came across not too long ago, quote of a Massachusetts congressman from 1795, Fisher Ames. He said that a monarchy is a merchantman, so a ship, which sails very well, but will sometimes strike on a rock and go to the bottom. A republic is a raft, which will never sink, but then your feet are always in the water. So just replace monarchy with administrative state, and I suppose this observation still holds true today. As we all have seen, efforts to address the pandemic necessarily implicate other critically important interests, such as the economy, the education of children, the mental and emotional health of the American people, among other things. Public health experts may be able to devise, at least in theory, a silver bullet solution to end the pandemic, whether it's lockdowns or mass mandatory vaccinations or what have you. But if the solution leads to massive economic dislocations, uneducated children, civil strife, and deaths of despair, then perhaps it's fair to say that the medicine is worse than the disease. Legislatures, not experts, are best situated to weigh the costs and benefits and balance competing interests. The chosen solution may not be the perfect one, but at least the ship won't sink. In Florida, we have tried to avoid falling for the cult of expertise. The Florida legislature, along with the governor, have made the most important decisions regarding the pandemic based on their assessments, consulting experts, of course, of the risks, the costs and benefits, and the interests of Floridians in all their diversity. They have banned vaccine passports. They have banned compelled masking of children in schools. They have required that schools stay open. They have encouraged vaccination, especially of the elderly, and have prioritized therapeutics. They have prohibited blanket vaccine mandates by employers, educational institutions, and government entities. And so then this leads me then to the third and final dimension of the who decides question. Should the government decide vaccine policy or the marketplace, the private sector? Governor DeSantis has been a strong advocate for the basic principle that no one should lose his or her job or be marginalized or denied access to the marketplace for refusing to be vaccinated. The legislature has acted on this principle by banning blanket employer vaccine mandates, that is, mandates that do not include very broad exemptions for religion, medical necessity, including pregnancy, prior COVID infection, weekly testing, the wearing of PPE. I know that many view this restriction as an unjustified infringement of the employer's liberty. If the employee doesn't like the employer's requirements and refuses to get the vaccine, so the argument goes, the employee can simply work somewhere else. Although I normally sympathize with this principle, I don't necessarily think it should control in the case of vaccine mandates. First, where work-related precautions are available to reasonably prevent transmission in the workplace, the employer really isn't justified in interfering in the personal medical and health decisions of an employee. It's just simply not any of the employer's business. This is especially the case if the vaccine doesn't sufficiently prevent transmission of the virus in the first place. Obviously, the less effective the vaccine is in preventing transmission, the weaker the employer's argument for imposing a vaccine mandate. Second, I question the extent to which in our current environment, and notwithstanding, you know, worker shortages and so forth, how easy it really is for workers to just, you know, quit their job and go find something else and not be subject to, you know, the vaccine mandate or an employer-imposed vaccine mandate. The concentration of economic power is a real phenomenon that I think we have to take more seriously. In Florida, for example, 0.2% of the employers account for a third of all the jobs in the state. 0.4% of employers account for 41.9% of all the jobs in the state. Just less than 1% account for almost half of all the jobs. And then when you combine that with the hive mentality that you're starting to see among corporate America, and ones, you know, where they tend to all agree on a one size approach to the problem, then it's not clear to me that the labor market is as flexible as some of our libertarian friends would think. So I think under those kind of circumstances, it might be reasonable for state governments, not the federal government, to step in and protect the individual. And that's it. That's it for me.
Thank you. And it's terrific. Each one of you raised topics, I think, that could be their own 2-hour further discussion, which we will not take it that far. I owe you all the rest of your days. But I want to open it up to either A, let you all respond a little bit to each other. I know numerous questions to each other were sprinkled across the way, whether it was how significant was the posture of these cases to the decision and what's ultimately left, questions about the major questions doctrine and non-delegation, but I'm also going to toss another question on the table and give you all the ability to kind of jump in on any of this, which is, you know, and seeing Dorit's background there, the elephant in the room, we haven't been talking about the CDC, and I understand that the CDC isn't a sort of a direct party in the way that the other government entities were, but, you know, sometimes institutions fight over who gets to decide, and other times they fight over who has to decide. And with so many institutions in this country at the local level, at the state level and beyond, relying on CDC guidance to set their own policies, whether that's as a matter of genuine, respectful deference or a matter of liability coverage, is it really the CDC that's deciding, even for lower level decision makers who themselves may have the actual authority? And how does anyone, institutions, states, et cetera, fight the CDC at its source if some of the questions go to the merits of the science and discussion, as much as to the niceties of which provision each agency is using in order to justify its particular vaccine mandate that comes numerous steps down the line after other more scientific bodies have gotten their chance to answer the particular question? So I hope between everything that you each said to each other and that additional dollop of a question on top, that gives us some points for discussion. And I'm happy to let anybody jump in.
I can potentially start, but if you prefer to have someone else start or someone else.
Go ahead.
I'll start with your question about the CDC, because it ties into something that I wanted to address anyway, which is Ryan Newman, to some extent, correctly contrasted sort of expert judgment with that of politicians. But I think the contrast may not be as vivid as that, in that if you look at the history of the CDC in particular during the pandemic, a lot of what they've done has not actually been just sort of quote unquote following the science or just their own expert judgment unconstrained by anybody else. Several of their biggest and most controversial measures have actually been at the behest of the White House. The eviction moratorium, which was struck down by the Supreme Court. We know the agency was very reluctant to do this, but first the Trump White House and later the Biden White House said, you know, we really want this for what are essentially political and policy reasons, and also because Congress chose not to do it themselves, except for a brief period. And so the CDC did that. I recently wrote an amicus brief in the Title 42 border public health explosions done by the CDC, also started by Trump and then continued by Biden. Here too, the story is actual scientific experts in the CDC highly doubted that this measure was effective or likely to do any good. There's even evidence that it actually makes public health worse. But first under Trump and under Biden, the CDC did this anyway because the White House wanted them to. I think with OSHA, there's a good chance there's a similar story, in that I think it's pretty obvious the initiative for this policy didn't come from experts at OSHA. It came from the White House. I'm sure experts had some input and details, but I think, you know, it's pretty clearly the case that the real movers and shakers are in the White House rather than at OSHA. So the real issue, I think, here, at least for many of these policies, is not you deferring to the expert judgment of the CDC or OSHA. It's how much concentration of power do we want to have in the White House? And sadly, people tend to be alive to this problem when the president doesn't belong to their party, but when their guy is in the White House or their woman, perhaps in the future, they're saying, oh, it's all fine. You know, he has to have as much discretion as he needs to meet the emergency, which is as much, which in practice often turns out to be as much discretion as he wants. And so I think while there are cases where there's too much deference to actual technical experts, and I agree with part of what Ryan said on that, these cases are actually not that. These are cases where the experts are being used in some ways as a front, first by the Trump White House, but later by the Biden White House. Finally, it's a small point on the freedom of the individual versus employers and the like. I think that's also a contrast that is not quite correctly drawn, in that when we forbid employers or store owners and the like from imposing vaccine mandates, it limits not just the freedom of the store owner or the employer. It also limits the freedom of those employees who want to work in a fully vaccinated workplace and would prefer that precaution to be in place. They now know do not have the option of going anywhere, at least within those states that have these sorts of policies. And the idea of like, well, it's 1% of employers control everything. You know, 1% is still a lot of different employers. There's competition between them. And obviously, you know, the other 99% of employers, you know, are also relevant. I would add that the relative size of employers is dynamic, not static. If most workers don't want vaccine mandates or other restrictions, then that will give an advantage in the hiring process to employers who, you know, who have different rules. And so the employer that was in the top 1% may find that they're no longer there anymore, if it really is the case that most workers object or that most customers object. So I think, you know, I'll repeat some of my call that for the left, I hope they will recover their traditional suspicion of government emergency powers of various kinds. For the right, I hope they will recover at least some of their traditional interest in private property and free markets.
I'm happy to jump in.
Yep.
There was a lot of in here, and I really want to leave time for the questions because I know there's a lot of questions. So I'll just say three things. And even though, again, we could talk about everything here for an hour, at least an hour. The three things I want to say is I completely agree that generally speaking, the states are the main driver on public health policy and have the plenary power. But the strength of our federalist system is that we have both options. And the federal government is supposed to be there for some of the things. I mean, the example I like for COVID is the smoking section in the plane. It is something that does run over state borders and does affect, and where we do affect each other. And while I think states should still be the main driver of the policy, I think there needs to be a role for the federal government. And the question is what it should be. I will say again, I think, I'm not sure I was clear enough about it. I think you can argue whether or not the OSHA mandate was a good or bad policy, but that's a separate question from who should decide. The second point I want to make is I still actually haven't heard a good answer for why a provision that gives limited emergency power that have to be used when there's a grave danger and it's necessary, regardless of how it's used, falls foul of the major question doctrine. And again, that's probably a problem within the doctrine. It's a big use of it, but the provision itself is very cabined. And I don't see why the question should be, does this meet the very demanding requirement of the provision, rather than are we going to ask Congress to delegate specific authority to confront emergencies that Congress doesn't know of in advance? And the third point I want to make is I want to bring back the courts. And when we're discussing who decides, remember that the broader the power of the court to strike down policies, the larger the power of the courts. And however imperfect bureaucrats, either in the states or in Washington are, the courts are also populated by people. And there's a question of how much power we want to give. I also want to echo Ilya's point that a prohibition on vaccine mandates is a prohibition. It doesn't allow private actors to act. And I don't think it prioritizes the rights of the employers that want a place where they don't have to vaccinate, or the customers that want to go into a place without vaccinating, over everyone else. It chooses between individuals. It doesn't protect everybody.
I will just add real quickly to that point. You're right that it's not completely neutral. No policies really ever are at the end of the day. And so, yes, a conscious decision was made that, you know, people ought not to be fired who don't want to get the vaccine. But that's still just a narrow prohibition. It's not as though employers don't have, you know, many other tools at their disposal to try to, you know, protect all of their employees and make the, you know, workplace a safe place for all of their employees. We're focused very narrowly on the question of, should somebody be outcast and fireable for not submitting to a forced vaccination? And so we've limited specifically to that question, but employers still have a wide range of options for addressing, you know, the interests of their employees. On the question of, you know, the role of the courts, it's not as though the court's deciding who decides in these cases. And so, yes, it invalidated the OSHA rule, but not because it disagreed with the OSHA rule, but because it thought that the legislature, Congress, should be deciding that question. Congress can pass a vaccine mandate if it wishes. The court didn't prohibit that.
Just to the point that Dory raises on major questions. I mean, I think often the focus on major questions has to do with this heightened standard that the courts are applying. They're just demanding so much more of this statute than they normally would. But I think maybe the proper focus is to look at the actual regulatory action that's being taken. And one of the things that strikes me that gets glossed over in all of this is how profound a requirement this vaccine mandate actually is. I mean, first of all, it's unprecedented. As a, you know, there's nothing clearly in the statutes that contemplate this. There are general provisions that the court considered, and in the CMS context, they concluded, you know, were broad enough to contemplate it. There's no regulatory history of this type of action, despite what the court says. I mean, the other types of conditions on participation are dramatically different. The fact is that at the end of the day, vaccines are a fundamental and irreversible invasion of bodily integrity for people who do not want them. They just are. And I think a lot of the way you view that depends on perhaps your view of vaccines in general. But that is the reality for people. And so I think when we think about major questions, it's not, you know, obviously there might be some heightened pleading requirement, but I don't think it's too much to ask that Congress actually clearly articulate something that is as dramatic as this. This is not a routine condition of participation. This does not flow naturally from anything that these agencies have done in the past. This is new, and this is dramatically different. And one other thing on a point that Ilya made, I think, you know, the fact is, I think this does leave the secretary's power open-ended, at least in the CMS context. I mean, if health and safety can contemplate this, you know, keep in one hand the fact that this is a big deal and this is something totally new that is being required. And this is something dramatically different from the other types of regulatory requirements that have been imposed before. Keep that in one hand. If he can do this under health and safety, it really is difficult to see what the limiting principle on that is in the future. And so, you know, the fact is we are left now with the regime, at least in the CMS context, where there's not limiting principles on the secretary's power. You know, remember, this vaccine mandate only applies to healthcare workers. What about the patients themselves? And what about the myriad other issues that the secretary might want to regulate directly in the interest of health and safety? And what about the fact that, as you all noted, the conception of health and safety could change dramatically based on who's in the White House? I mean, this is why I think it's totally reasonable to expect that Congress has to speak clearly when this type of action is contemplated. And as to the major question in this panel, you know, who gets to decide? I mean, for purposes of the litigation, you know, the question was really, can the federal government do it or not under the existing authorities that are out there? And obviously, you know, my position on that. But you know, I think by leaving it to the states, you can have a lot of these discussions about the relative deciding power of individuals versus companies and corporations and things like that. But I think when you federalize it like this, you totally eliminate you eliminate the variety that you get in the different states. Montana is very similar to Florida in the regime that we've established, where it's illegal to discriminate on the basis of vaccine status. But on the back end, we've raised liability standards for businesses who might be sued for some sort of COVID-related liability. And so we've protected businesses from that on the back end, but we've also sought to protect individual rights by prohibiting any sort of discrimination on the basis of vaccine status. And so again, like that's the consensus in the state of Montana. That's the result we reached here. You know, Florida has reached their result. New York is going to reach a different result. And I think when you defederalize these actions, I think that's, you're allowed to actually experiment and deal with these things. And while COVID is obviously a national issue, I still think emergency or no, we have to observe the rules and the laws that are in place. Those don't get suspended. Those don't get suspended just because we're dealing with something novel and something that's considered a health emergency.
I'm seeing a fair number of questions that are about the practical effects, what the landscape looks like going forward. And I'll put maybe a twist on that too, which is, you know, we're talking about who should decide. We like to think of the Supreme Court has now made that decision, at least initially, maybe permanently, depending on how one reads those decisions. But the practical reality, or let me ask the question, isn't the practical reality when the president makes an announcement that something is coming, it is then on its way, there is question about whether it will go into effect or not, and all those puzzle pieces are falling into place and the emergency powers are being invoked, you have a lot of people moving ahead of that. Right? Big employers across state lines that are putting the mandate in anticipatorily, maybe don't feel as though they can wait to start to engage in that compliance. You have individuals that may have been very much opposed to taking the vaccine themselves, but saw the writing on the wall and wanted to be ahead of it and into that process and concerned about how long of a lag there might be. But a lot of things can happen and a lot of effect can happen just by virtue of putting something out there in the way the federal government did, even if it's ultimately struck down. And so, you know, I'm just wondering if anybody can speak to that. And I think Ilya spoke to that a little bit about this invocation of emergency authority of what does the landscape look like now? What does the patchwork look like now? And what does this mean for individuals as to what they do going forward and how they're going to keep up with what fully vaccinated is?
So I can speak to that a little bit, though, if others want to go ahead. So there's only two issues. One is the specific issue raised, well, what if the president or some other high government official announces something, maybe people will preemptively comply, even if what he wants isn't legal. I don't think there's an easy answer to that problem because we can't prevent, for the most part, at least the president from saying stuff. However, if we know that at the back end, there will be strong non-deferential judicial review, then some things the president says or other officials say can be, intelligent private actors can discount them if they know there's a high probability that what he says will not actually come to pass, but there's no way to completely prevent presidents or other officials from engaging in that sort of behavior. That's just a fact of life of sort of a modern state that has as much power as the current state does. On the practical implications of the rulings, I think the ETS mandate is practically speaking a dead letter. However, the court did leave room for a more limited potential ETS workplace mandate for employment situations where these are unusually crowded or for other reasons might be especially high COVID risk. So it's possible, perhaps even likely, that the Biden administration will have OSHA try to craft a narrower rule. Then that narrower rule will itself be challenged in litigation, and we'll see see, you know, what happens on that. I think on the healthcare worker rule, there is still some uncertainty, but it is going to go into effect. I think a large number of healthcare employers actually support this rule and the like. So I think there will be a lot of compliance, though there might be some holdouts and there are some issues, as I think it might have been David who pointed out, there are some issues that this decision doesn't address, like spending clause arguments. I have some spending clause expertise myself. I think the government could and should prevail here, at least under current spending clause jurisprudence, but it wasn't addressed by the Supreme Court and will have to be addressed probably by lower courts. There's also a small subset of employees, about 3% of the covered employees, which, as the court noted in a footnote, you have to read the footnotes in these decisions sometimes. They noted in a footnote, those people aren't actually covered by the health and safety language. And therefore, I think it may be that with respect to that subset of workers, the rule really is illegal in application, and that group of people or their employers can potentially sue and say, like, these people are not covered. That's a very small proportion of the total. There are probably some other uncertainties as well, some which have to do with the larger situation in the world, which is if the Omicron wave passes and we don't have another big wave, and the second is a significant if, unfortunately, there will be less incentive or less pressure to do these kinds of more sweeping sorts of measures to begin with. So we'll have to see on that.
Can I follow up with one comment? And I think Alida is getting ready to wrap up. But I wanted to say, as far as reading the tea leaves go, I suspect we won't see another ETS or even an attempted congressional action. And my logic is a timing logic. I think that the issue is, to construct an ETS that has even some remote chance of surviving court, you need time. I don't think they can take this and transfer it to another ETS. The way agencies move, we're talking about weeks or months. And the issue is, the problem is the winter. In 2 months, one way or the other, I think things will be much clearer. So I don't see them, given the timing, coming up with another ETS. I would expect them to pivot to other efforts. To this point, that's my guess. In terms of the patchwork, we really are seeing a patchwork of policies across states. 24 states have some measure to limit or prohibit vaccine mandates. Most of those are just for government. And since no government has imposed the kind of mandate that this prohibit, which is you can't use government services or can't go into government building without a vaccine or an exemption, I think they're more symbolic than real. 9 states have bans on customer mandates, on requiring a mandate in private place, and 8 states have bans on employment mandates. On the other hand, we have states that have imposed some kind of a workplace mandate for at least some professions. We have several states that impose mandates on healthcare workers, teachers, or more. We have several states that impose mandates on state personnel. So we really are seeing a very big patchwork with different approaches in different states, and that will probably continue.
Okay. I think, Alida, do you want to speak? But thank you. I think we've reached the end of our time today and really appreciate the insights and expertise of all of our panelists and the questions that came in as well. And I think numerous times you all were kind of answering them along the way. But Alida, I turn it over to you.
Thank you so much to Kate, our moderator, and all of our panelists. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank all of you for the benefit of your time and expertise today. And I want to thank our audience for joining and participating in this event and submitting some really good, thoughtful questions that I think provoked and prompted a great discussion. We also welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. As always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about upcoming events. Thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.